This is Tax Update for Saturday, December 3rd, 2005. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. This week's podcast: Breaking Up is Hard to Tax, Alimony and Recent Cases. This week we're going to look at a subset of the issues involved in determining whether a payment is alimony, as well as two recent cases that came down the alimony question. The cases in question are D.E. Lofstrom, 125 T.C. No. 13, and D.K. Varnasdal, T.C. Summary Opinion 2005-170, that actually came down a day apart from each other. In both cases, taxpayers unsuccessfully attempted to have various payments classified as alimony. Alimony issues are tricky, in part because this area of the tax law, there's a mirroring and cross-reporting of income and deduction. If the payer gets a deduction for alimony, the recipient has to pick this up as income. You also have a pair of participants who quite often aren't getting along well at all. Therefore, there's a bit of a battle ensuing already, and this merely becomes one more battleground as to how the tax will be imposed on the payments going from one spouse to the other. Because of that, we tend to see a lot of litigation in this area. And because of that, we also find that usually rather than two parties involved in a dispute, we have three. We have spouse one, spouse two, and IRS. Looking at this triple threat. Now, basically, let's take a look here to see what comes in. The tough part is, the way the law works, it is tough to qualify a payment as alimony. Essentially, the default treatment under the code is not alimony. A payment only becomes alimony if it meets very tight criteria. Under the Internal Revenue Code, Section 71 essentially governs this definition. Now, as you may note, we have income and we have an expense. Therefore, it would seem like there would be two sections. Well, there are, but the way the rule works here, Section 215 essentially refers back to Section 71 to pick up its definition. Section 215 allows a deduction. Section 71 requires the inclusion in income. The only real addition Section 215 puts on is the requirement of providing the identification number. So essentially, the payor gets the deduction if they're paying something that has to be included in income under 71 by the other party, and is also providing the employer identification number as required by regulations. So for the most part, we're going to ignore 215 for now, but just realize if 71 says it's income to the recipient, then 215 allows us a deduction for the payor. Now, traditionally, because the tougher side is to get it in as alimony, much of our litigation, including the cases we see here today, are usually the question about the payor spouse and whether the payment is truly alimony. Usually, our problem is that it is, as we said, the difficulty of getting there, because it's easy to exclude it. It is difficult to include it. Essentially, there are four tests for what is alimony. The meat of Section 71 is found in Section 71B that divides into 1 and 2, two parts. Under 1 are the four straight tests. Under 2 is essentially the requirements that tell us what the type of agreement document we need to have to be functioning under for something to be alimony. So we have to have the right type of payment, and then it must be under the right type of document. Now, Section 71B1 starts out, the term alimony or separate maintenance payment means any payment in cash. Now, that little requirement, as you'll find, is what trips up one of our cases today. But remember, an alimony payment must be in cash. If such payment is received, this is A, the first test, on behalf of a spouse under a divorce or separation instrument. Now, what is a divorce or separation instrument is what number two starts telling us about later. But just understand, it's got to meet the instrument test. B, the divorce or separation instrument does not designate such payment as a payment which is not includable in gross income under this section and not allowable as a deduction under Section 215. B is an important exception. What it tells us is, regardless of everything else we find about the payment, all I as a recipient need to have placed in the document is a recitation that essentially this shall not be alimony and not includable in gross income under Section 71 and not deductible under Section 215. If that clause is in the document, we have the end of our conversation. We're now finished because we know this is not alimony. So watch out for B. It is an exclusion. When you are studying a divorce document, if you find this sentence, you've got it. If you are representing spouses and the intent is for this payment stream not to be alimony, obviously a suggestion can be made that this provision simply be written in, especially if you are representing the recipient spouse. The recipient spouse would like to see this in here because with that in there, there will not be a question at this point. It is not includable in that spouse's income. So that's how we get it out for B. Now C, also in the case of an individual legally separated from his spouse under a decree of divorce or separate maintenance, the payee spouse and the payor spouse are not members of the same household at the time such payment is made. Okay, if the parties are legally separated, they cannot reside in the same household. Normally, that's not a problem. In most divorces, in my experience, the last thing the two parties would want to be is residing in the same household. But it is important to keep in your mind, keep the situation in the background just in case of an unusual situation, or in case you had a situation where someone decided to get cute and was trying to game a system here by playing an alimony payment divorce but not really divorce, and then have an alimony payment to shift income. Clearly, that was Congress's concern that we could have a divorce that was entered into for tax planning purposes, get two single individuals, shift income as necessary, and voila, we fixed the whole issue. That might make sense, to be honest, especially with the marriage penalty issues. Obviously, Congress decided do-it-yourself marriage penalty fixing was not something they wanted to see Section 71 used for. Finally, number four, there is no liability to make any such payment for any period after the death of the payee spouse, and there is no liability to make any payment in cash or property as a substitute for such payments after the death of the payee spouse. This particular provision, while not the issue in the two cases we had come down this week, has quite often been the issue when we have payments that are unclear. The question becomes, under state law, would this payment, if it wasn't specified, be one that would be deemed to continue after the death of the recipient, or would it be a payment that would cease on the death of the recipient? That, in many cases, is not clear. This is where we get into something that can be extraordinarily confusing and may involve expertise outside of that traditionally held by a tax practitioner. You need to come to a conclusion. If you look at the divorce document and it is not clear, the document does not provide, there is no liability to make payment after the death of this spouse, but doesn't clearly say there is a liability continues after the death, then you're going to have to get some ruling from someone competent to rule on the state law. And by ruling, I mean from an attorney or someone who is specialized in the area, as to whether or not there is a clear understanding whether the payment would or would not continue after that person's death. If the answer is it would continue, then it is not includable. If the answer it would not continue, then it would not. If you can be involved prior to the divorce going final, it would be very, very useful for you to make clear that we shouldn't leave a dangling provision like this. If we intend for it to be alimony, then it's got to stop when this person dies and we can't replace it. And we need to adjust our agreements otherwise if that's a problem. Or if the idea is it should not be alimony, then either we need a clear statement this continues beyond the person's death, or we need to otherwise disqualify it. But it's very, very iffy and can involve a lot of litigation and expense later if you end up having to push the case all the way through the courts for the tax court to attempt to determine whether or not state law would require, under a certain situation, a payment under this divorce decree to continue after the death of the spouse who is receiving the payment. Now, the question becomes, what is a divorce or separation agreement? That's where B2 comes in. Divorce or separation agreement means a decree of divorce or separate maintenance or a written instrument incident to such a decree, a written separation agreement, or a decree not described in subparagraph A, requiring a spouse to make payments for support or maintenance of the other spouse. You need one of those three documents. You need essentially decrees, that's A and C, or you need a written separation agreement or a written instrument incident to such a decree. So whatever document you have has to fall into one of those categories. If it does not, you don't have alimony. The parties can't informally or orally basically make this work. You're going to need a written agreement to make this happen. Now, part of the theory of alimony is the Congress was concerned about disguised payments. And while the cases don't deal with this, and we're not going to go into a lot of detail today on these concepts, you have to understand that there really are three types of payments that Congress saw as constituting what would normally be transferred in a divorce. Or basically the type of wealth transfers, shall we say, between spouses. There would be alimony, which is spousal support, whatever you wish to call it, that's payment. There's property settlement to divide what the spouses owned during their marriage. And there's child support to provide for the parental obligation to support the children of the marriage. There are two additional provisions in Section 71 that are designed to deal with attempts to disguise payments for the other two, property settlement or child support, as alimony for tax purposes. The concern here is that essentially there may be an arbitrage at work, shall we say, where the payments are going to a spouse whose tax bracket is expected to be lower. And what we can do is get more money net to that spouse if we can make everything alimony and still have a lower cost to the spouse paying by making all of these transfers alimony. Now, that arbitrage effect is still important and actually is there and is something to be considered if the parties can be rational enough about their discussions with each other to actually make this go. There are ways to really make it pay by using the arbitrage effect so that both parties make out better than they would otherwise. Again, sometimes the emotions of a divorce keep us from getting anywhere near something as rational as that solution, but it's important to remember. It's also important to remember that while we have these rules about disguised payments, in general, these rules on disguised payments are mechanical. So with some planning, you can make the arbitrage work actually to a much better extent than you might otherwise believe possible if you just understand the mechanics here, as well as understanding that whatever you do is still going to have to pass muster with the family court. For instance, a family court generally is not going to feel good about having no child support in play. They're going to require some payment from the non-custodial parent. That said, the amount of that payment definitely can be managed. Now, let's deal first with disguised child support. Section 71C, payments to support children, basically says it's not alimony if it falls under this category. And the key issue here is any amount that is payment of child support shall not count as alimony. So if we call it child support, it's not alimony, and we're ready to go. So basically, definitionally, if it's child support, that amount will not be alimony. But we also then have disguised child support. If your payments are reduced based upon a contingency relating to a child, this is under Section 71(c)(2), that will not be alimony. And it'll be reduced if it's on the happening of a contingency specified in the instrument relating to a child. This is under A. And the examples provided in parentheses, such as attaining a specified age, marrying, dying, leaving school, or a similar contingency. So we are looking for any contingency relating to the child will convert it to child support. Or at a time that can be clearly associated with contingency of a time specified in A. So if you try to get cute and try to figure out a way around the age of the child by coming up with some method that would be equivalent to the age of the child in the court's view, then essentially, or the death of the child or some other situation, then we treat it as child support. So you have to watch for any reason why the alimony would reduce that relates in any way, shape, or form to the child. If we have a contingency that would reduce the payment that is shown to relate to the child, contingency of the child, it's not alimony. It is treated as effectively child support. And also it says, when a rule is payment is less than the amount specified in the instrument, if any payment is less than the amount specified in the instrument, so much as such payment as does not exceed the sum payable for support shall be considered a payment for support. That means if the taxpayer gets behind, basically we lose alimony first. So if the taxpayer simply doesn't pay, then essentially it first comes out of alimony, not child support. Now realize your state law may feel differently at that point, but that's a whole nother issue. This is federal law and taxation. A second, more complex, though mainly mechanical provision is found to prevent spouses from disguising a property settlement as alimony. What we're looking for here is excessive front-end loading, shall we say. For instance, traditionally in a property settlement, the spouse is paid a sum of money, receives property, at the divorce date or shortly thereafter. The concern here was that such a payment might be labeled alimony again to play arbitrage. The payor spouse gets a large deduction. The payee spouse will pick it up as income, the recipient spouse picks it up as income. Payee spouse picks up as income. But the payee spouse's rate is so much lower that the arbitrage works to our benefit as opposed to having a totally non-taxable, non-deductible transaction. Net, both parties can be net better off. The spouse paying is net out-of-pocket less because of the tax reduction. The recipient spouse has more in-pocket because of the much greater gross number received, and the reduction in tax was less than the increase in tax was less than the amount the payment would have been reduced under a purely non-taxable transfer. Note, though, that a payment meets... Now, the test for this is mechanical in the extreme. So it doesn't matter if there's good faith. It doesn't matter if it wasn't intended. It doesn't matter. If you fail the mechanical tests involved in this provision, you have a problem. And essentially, you basically are looking at payments over the first 3 years and looking at excessive payments. We get the first year treated as alimony by default. But if the second year drops too much, then essentially we go back and we pick up excess payments on the first year. Similarly, if the third year drops too much over the first and second year, then we go back and pick up payments from them as not alimony and add them back. Now, the tests here, which are found in Section 71F, beginning at 1, which we found at 1, basically, and 71F2, the excess alimony payment computations, are purely mechanical. This one is a no-brainer if you run the numbers. You will determine up front, essentially, or can normally determine up front, if you have a specified or a proposed agreement you can basically compute, will this agreement run afoul of these provisions? Now, there are some exceptions to the computation. You're allowed to have it drop if either spouse dies or remarries before the close of the third separation year, and the payments cease based on that death or remarriage. If that is the case, then in fact, the payments are, that reduction is not going to count against the taxpayer in determining whether the amounts were alimony. If there are fluctuating payments that are not within the control of the payer or spouse, and what that means is if the alimony is fixed based on earnings, let's say from self-employment, business, property, other things that are tied by basically how things work out from an income or an income generator, basically from employment, self-employment, those types of items, income from business or property, in those cases, then that also will not be counted against. If there was a decrease that was caused by those items, that decrease doesn't count against us. Now, the separation year, we have three separation years, and they're important. The first separation year means the first calendar year in which the payor paid alimony or separate maintenance. The second and third year are the two following. So you identify the 3 years. That means it may be important when the decree goes final. Remember, our testing period essentially stops. We get our 2 years in. If we can get the payment to year three, we're fine. The payment can be in year three, essentially, 12 months and 1 day after the divorce, 12 months or 2 days almost after the divorce. You were divorced on December 31st of 2005. A payment made January 1st of 2007. If you got December 31st, 2005 was your first payment, you could take a payment January 1st, 2007 would be in the third separation year. So that may be important. It may be an important trigger. It may also cause you to have problems if a divorce for some reason slips, or let's say the payment slip and suddenly that first payment was made in 2006, then your third year slips now back a full 12 months. But key, run the numbers. What is crucial in alimony is there are two cases you'll be involved in. First, you'll be involved on the front end. If you're involved on the front end before the decree is finalized and you are working with one or the other of the taxpayers, and this is a clear area where conflicts are huge if you try to represent both taxpayers, especially on the question of alimony, because clearly the interests are different on a payment. But if you're representing one of the spouses and you're working with their counsel, it's important to take a look at the agreement and make sure that everyone has considered the tests here. What do we think the tax result should be? And if the document is drafted properly, we should be able to assure the results we want. So that's why it's crucial to be involved up front. If you're involved up front, you should get it right. That also means if you're involved up front, this is a place you do not want to drop the ball. If the client or the attorney is relying on you to provide counsel in this matter, be sure you take a careful look at the document and make sure you make it clear to all parties that you need to review this document before it goes final, because minor changes can have a major tax difference. The other way you get involved is after the fact, representing one of the spouses. In that case, you may be looking for or representing a spouse and having to determine, based upon a divorce decree that is now final and done and finished, what is the result. This will happen with the client that walks in during tax season. In that case, you've got to walk the fixed document through the hoops and see where things are. Some cases, like the question about whether the payment truly terminates on the death of the spouse, are going to may very well have to go back to family tax, to the family court counsel, who will have to tell you what is the family law standings here. Would these payments continue after death? And you may sometimes have to explain why this is important. Hopefully, counsel involved understood that and has the answer immediately as to which way it will go and considered that, hopefully you're not discovering this was an issue no one had considered when the decree was finalized. Now, we have two cases that have come down recently that dealt with the question of whether payment was alimony. In both cases, the taxpayer who claimed an alimony deduction lost the case. The first case in question is interesting because it was a reported tax court case, and those aren't the type we see real often in the divorce cases anymore. Usually these are standard and pretty much cookie-cutter cases. But this was the case of Lofstrom, and it was unique because the taxpayer had gotten behind in paying his alimony. And what he ended up doing raised a unique question that ran afoul of the problem of cash payment. In this case, the taxpayer had managed to transfer to his spouse after falling behind in his alimony payments a note payable actually from their son to the taxpayer that the former spouse took in satisfaction of the entire remaining obligation for alimony. What the taxpayer wanted to take the position, in this case, $4,000 in cash and a debt for $29,000 from his son, now to his former spouse, under a contract for deed under Minnesota law. The contract entitled his former spouse principal and interest until the note was paid, and payment would continue regardless of whether she survived the date of final payoff of the debt. The court ruled that the payment was neither cash nor a cash equivalent as required under Section 71(b)(1) and Regulation 1.71-1TB, Question and Answer 5. In essence, those required cash payments, the court held in this case, which is what made it reported as unique, was that this debt to a third party, nevertheless, it was not a cash equivalent. And it also noted that it felt this probably failed as well because the son was still obligated to pay his mother, regardless, or his mother's estate, even if she passed away. In essence, the note was unconditional obligation for future payment of cash. Therefore, the court held, even if it decided that this was an equivalent for the cash, since it did not cease on her death, it didn't qualify. In a more traditional case that was a summary opinion, these are the types we quite often see, a taxpayer lost out when trying to make a hyper-technical reading of the divorce decree and the requirement of Code Section 71(b)(1)(b). What the taxpayer attempted to say was that this particular document, which the taxpayer claimed otherwise would qualify as alimony, there was a provision that certainly the recipient spouse believed satisfied the requirement of 71(b)(1)(b) that said the payment would not be treated as alimony for federal tax purposes, not reportable as income, not deductible by the payor spouse. Now, the decree actually stated all payments due from husband to wife and provision of this article shall constitute property settlement and not maintenance or alimony. Now, if you remember the structure of Section 71, if we said it was child support, it was an alimony. But the provision never said if we said it was property settlement, it was an alimony. It just has this secondary test. And the literal wording of 71(b)(1)(b) requires, it says, if the decree states it's not includable as income under Section 71 nor deductible or deductible under Section 215, I should say. Well, didn't say that exactly either. So Mr. Vanderzal said, hey, you know what? Because it failed those tests, I think it's alimony. The court said, sorry, we don't think you go there. Now, Mr. Vanderzal did cite two cases, Richardson versus Commissioner, which was a Seventh Circuit case affirming a tax court memorandum decision from 1995, and a tax court memo decision from 2000. Now, the Richardson case, basically, payments were made from one ex-spouse to another, made no mention of the nature or characterization of the payments. Basically, the agreement was silent, and in the Richardson case, the court held if it was silent and basically it wasn't clear what it was, non-alimony, then it'll be treated as alimony if it otherwise qualifies. There was no, in this case, it's the court said, we're sorry, we think this qualifies as a clear distinction. In the Baker case, the agreement had labeled the payments as property settlement, but otherwise everything would count for alimony. So the question was a mere labeling a property settlement enough? The court handled no, that wasn't enough to make it not alimony. The fact was property settlement didn't go. In this case, though, as the court points out, the agreement specifically states payments are not maintenance or alimony. It also, we went into some discussions in the agreement that specifically had the former spouse reimburse Mr. Vandersall for her portion of the taxes that he would have to pay on the income from a partnership that was going to generate part of these payments. Clearly, the tax consequences, the court said, were just considered by the parties, so we can't say nobody understood that this was meant to be a tax waiver. All parties should have understood it. Basically, the court felt that Mr. Vandersall was trying to change things after the fact, play it a little too neat, and tried to be a little too fancy, and said, sorry, guys, we're not going to give it. Now, as I noted, these are cases where conflicts are huge in representing spouses. You need to be very, very careful if you ever decide to represent two spouses and be very cognizant of the requirements for conflict notices under Circular 230 in these cases, because alimony, as these cases prove, often generate disputes among the spouses as to the nature of the payments. As well, please remember from a practical standpoint, the more difficult position to hold is the payments are alimony unless they agreed up front. So in absence of a clear agreement that makes it clear from the property, from the divorce decree that these payments were to be considered taxable alimony, your spouse likely has an uphill fight if you are representing the taxpayer who wants to claim the payments as alimony. So be very careful looking at that information. Again, this has been Tax Update for Saturday, December 3rd, 2005. Tax Update is intended for those who can do their own independent research and is not intended for those who are not skilled in such matters. Please independently confirm anything contained in this podcast before taking action on it. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, December 3rd, 2005.